This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
That $800 million that's on the list is real. Imagine having $800 million coming back onto the Nostra accounts. It makes a huge difference.
That's Terence Mukupi, Zimbabwe's Deputy Minister of Finance and Economic Development, talking about the money that has been repatriated to the country. Details coming up. Also, the return of more than 100 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram in Dapchi is raising concerns about the religious divide in Nigeria, and aid workers in Uganda are struggling to help the thousands of people who have fled ethnic violence sweeping through the northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the return of more than 100 schoolgirls abducted from the Nigerian town of Dapchi by the Boko Haram extremist sect is raising concerns about the religious divide in the country. The one Dapchi girl still in captivity is the sole Christian. Nigerian Christians are demanding her immediate return. Chika Odua reports from Dakar.
Across Nigeria, people are praying for the return of Leah Sharibu. The 15-year-old Sharibu was among more than 100 schoolgirls who were abducted by a Boko Haram faction more than a month ago in the rural town of Dapchi in northeastern Nigeria. Earlier this week, Boko Haram returned nearly all of the girls, with the exception of five who died along the way to Dapchi, and Leah. VOA spoke to Leah's father, Nathan Sharibu.
They told her to convince to Muslim, and she said she would not convince to Muslim. Hence, she is the only Christian among them.
He said he is proud of his daughter for maintaining her Christian identity in the face of the insurgents. Sources in Dapchi told VOA that according to the returned girls, Leah was left behind. They said Boko Haram had told her to wear hijab, but she refused. When Boko Haram returned the Dapchi girls on Wednesday, Leah's mother fainted when she realized her daughter was not among them. Leah's mother is still in shock, too traumatized to speak. She was rushed to the hospital, according to her husband, Nathan Sharibu. He said they are all grieving Leah, but are happy to know that she is still alive.
Very quiet. Leah is very quiet. She doesn't talk much. But she used to play with her junior one. Yes, she liked school very, very much, and she liked church activities very, very much.
Christian groups are demanding for the Nigerian government to secure Leah's return. Some people suspect that the federal government is discriminating along religious lines. Nigeria is divided nearly 50-50 between Muslims and Christians. Religious biases have often led to deadly sectarian strife across the country, and some worry that this week's events may do more harm. Emmanuel Ogebe is a U.S.-based Nigerian lawyer and rights activist.
Sadly, this particular incident has basically twisted the knife of division in Nigeria a little more. The terrorists just really ruined things by hitting Leah back. That wasn't necessary. They claim, and it is often said that there's no compulsion in Islam, and for that reason alone, they should have let her go. So this is not good.
Boko Haram is divided into two competing factions, and analysts believe the one that abducted the Dapchi girls is the relatively less violent one, led by Abu Musab al-Barnawi. When militants released the Dapchi girls Wednesday morning, they stayed to preach to the community for about 20 minutes. They told them not to allow their daughters to return to the government school where Christian and Muslim children study together. There is also an Islamic school in Dapchi, which the insurgents left untouched when they kidnapped the girls in February. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is currently meeting with some of the returned Dapchi schoolgirls in the capital, Abuja. Through a press statement, he vowed to rescue Leah Sheribu and said he is fully aware of his duty to protect all Nigerians, irrespective of their religious affiliation. Chika Odua for VOA News, Dakar.
This week, Zimbabwe president released a list of companies said to have illegally transferred hundreds of millions of dollars out of the country. The government is threatening to prosecute the companies unless they bring the money home. Lawyers and the opposition say the president's tactic is a publicity stunt, one that lacks legal authority. Sebastian Mumfu has the report from Harare.
In hopes of reviving the ailing economy, Zimbabwe's government has set out to repatriate as much as $1.4 billion it says was transferred abroad illegally in recent years. This week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa released a list of companies that have not cooperated with his campaign. He said more than $820 million has yet to be returned, despite him extending a three-month amnesty period that began in December. Tendai Biti is an opposition leader and Zimbabwe's former finance minister. He says the issue of externalizing funds ended in 2009 when Zimbabwe abandoned its worthless dollar and adopted a multi-currency system, which is largely dominated by the US dollar.
The US dollar is legal tender in this country. Now, when you talk of externalization, you are talking of getting foreign currency, i.e. money which is not the legal tender of that country outside Zimbabwe. The key solution and the key problem to our economy is not money that has been externalized, in inverted commas. It's because we're not producing. And when we're not exporting, we cannot earn foreign currency receipts.
But Terence Mukupe, Zimbabwe's Deputy Minister of Finance and Economic Development, says repatriating money is key to reviving Zimbabwe's long struggling economy.
That $800 million that's on the list is real. Imagine having $800 million coming back onto the nostril accounts. It makes a huge difference. You're talking of a quarter of our import bill. So if we're able to bring back $1 billion, guess what? That chance for the ordinary person, Arukuma Jeja. It changes the lives of people.
Agents Gumbo, a lawyer, said the government must find a way to encourage companies to return their funds besides threatening them with lawsuits.
I agree with him that externalization is part of the problem that we have as a nation. But what I'm saying is, let's look at the legal regime that we ourselves have set up for ourselves and see whatever we are suggesting, whatever we are proposing and putting on the table, is it then going to be enforceable in the future?
He agreed with BT that since Zimbabwe adopted the US dollar as part of its currency, externalization charges might not stick in court should President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government decide to prosecute. Gumbo also noted that some of the companies listed as having externalized money were struggling to have their customers pay them. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The wave of ethnic violence sweeping through northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo has forced tens of thousands of people from their homes. Nearly 50,000 have crossed into Uganda. For VOA, Halima Atumani reports from Sibagoro, landing site in western Uganda.
The waters of Lake Albert look beautiful and even inviting, but they can also be dangerous. The UN says several Congolese refugees have died this year, making the five-hour crossing to Uganda in rickety boats. More continue to arrive every day. They are fleeing communal violence in Congo's Ituri province. Tam Daniel Rogers is a UNHCR field officer at Sebagoro landing site.
And some are even taking cattle, like goats, like chicken, like cows. So one of the boats that capsized was apparently carrying 27 cows. All the cows died, but the human beings were rescued.
Many of the refugees VOA saw arrive came with few belongings. Many are searching for lost children and loved ones. Dunia Sikwetu Sorongani has not seen his wife in a month. He says when the attackers came, they came in the night and killed many youth who were in the neighborhood. I was inside the gate and heard cries outside. When I got out to check, I found all my neighbors had been killed with machetes. I was forced to run. At Sebagoro landing site, volunteers call for the new arrivals to line up to board the bus. There is pushing. The refugees say they are exhausted. Tit-for-tat conflict between the Hema and Lendu communities in the Ituri province of DRC has simmered for decades, often over land. Survivors say, unlike in the past, they were given no warning of recent attacks, and women are not spared. Refugee Chantal Love says they burned my house and all my belongings, so we had to run empty-handed. Even the clothes I am wearing now were given to me by Good Samaritans at the border. She got away with her two children. Her parents and other family members were killed. In the span of 3 days in mid-March, the UN Refugee Agency said 4,000 people from Ituri crossed into Uganda. The new arrivals eventually make their way to the Changwali refugee settlement, many still coming to grips with the violence they fled. Refugee Kaigwa Sher says, I've heard on the radio the Lendu saying they are our brothers. But why is it that when those people come and start cutting people with machetes, arrows, spears and axes, why is it the soldiers don't retaliate? Why? That surprises me. If it's politics, we don't know. The reception center in Kagoma has grown overcrowded. Changwali authorities fear for another outbreak of cholera. In February, more than 600 refugees were infected and 26 died. Now the Uganda Red Cross is taking no chances. But even with such reminders, Red Cross volunteers say they struggle to enforce hand-washing rules. Since 2016, Uganda has taken in more than 1 million refugees from South Sudan, seriously straining resources. Amid the steady influx this year from Congo, Ugandan authorities only know too well that they need urgent donor support. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Changwali, Uganda.
Most financial markets around the world tumbled today, a day after U.S. President Donald Trump said he would impose new tariffs on Chinese products, raising the prospect of a trade war. In Africa, the FTSE JSE Top 40 Index in Johannesburg fell 1.30%. Nairobi's NSE Top 20 Index was off about a quarter of a point. However, in New York, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was flat in early afternoon trading. Gold, a key export for some African states, jumped nearly 1% in Asia and Europe. Many investors buy gold when stock markets are volatile. Oil prices also rose slightly. Base metal prices fell on fears of lower demand because of U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs. Nickel fell about 1% in London trading. Copper lost about a quarter of a point. South Africa's rand was up slightly as investors hope the ratings agency Moody's will not cut the country's credit rating. Tunisia is the only Arab Spring country where democratization has been successful. Despite elections and a new constitution, it continues to search for a response to violations of human rights during decades of dictatorship. From Washington, reporter Mohammed Al-Shenawi has the story.
Following the revolution of 2011, Tunisia eventually set up a Truth and Dignity Commission to lead the transitional justice process. Its mandate includes investigating all human rights violations since 1955. The commission has received over 62,000 cases and has heard testimony from about 11,000 Tunisians. It is expected to release its final report and recommendations in 2018 or 2019. However, the body has been met with resistance from President Baji Qaid Essebsi, who was Interior and Defense Minister during years of dictatorship. He has refused to take part in public hearings, declaring that the past should be laid to rest. Also, the commission has no access to files from the Interior Ministry or from military courts. Anna Maryam Rocatello, the Deputy Director of the International Center of Transitional Justice in New York, cites some of the challenges facing the commission.
Number one is a general hostility from the current administration towards the process of transitional justice and accountability in general. And the second one that I would mention as very problematic is the situation of little support that the Truth and Dignity Commission is receiving at this very crucial moment where their mandate is about to expire and the countries seem to have gotten into a very controversial debate about the extension of this mandate.
Rocatello says the government is obstructing accountability for the crimes of the past by issuing what's called administrative reconciliation law. It grants amnesty to public officials who were involved in corruption during the dictatorship if they prove they didn't personally gain from it. She says the law contradicts the goal of ending impunity. In addition, even though the accused may not have earned money or other benefits, individuals may have been harmed though. There is no possibility for them to seek legal redress. Lastly, she is worried about the qualifications of the special judges who would preside over the cases.
One of my biggest concerns has been the lack of a process whereby judges and prosecutors are reviewed to determine their suitability to take office in a specialized jurisdiction mandated to look into the violations committed by a former dictatorship. The first thing you have to ensure is the confidence of the society at large ensures that everybody is accountable to the law, that nobody is above the law.
Fadil Ali Reza is a Tunisian political analyst. He says the commission has faced several obstacles. They include a lack of funding and access to various government archives. The commission was also subjected to a smear campaign by the current government. He agrees that the administrative reconciliation law impedes justice.
The so-called administrative reconciliation law is in effect a corruption amnesty law. This law, which was very unpopular, written by ex-regime figures, supported by ex-regime figures, that grants blanket amnesty for corruption by ex-regime figures, does not seem particularly conducive to transitional justice.
Ali Reza says Tunisian parties close to the old regime are against extending the mandate of the Truth and Dignity Commission. He says they want to end investigations and potential punishment. Experts agree that Tunisia and the victims of past abuses must go through the process of transitional justice to heal. Otherwise, they say old wounds would continue to spread hatred. For VOA News, Mohammed El-Shinawi, Washington.
23 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Authorities have closed over 700 churches and a mosque in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Another 75 have been shuttered in Rawamagan district. The government says the buildings violate health and safety standards. However, some pastors say the closing violate the constitution and that requirements were fabricated. For almost 2 weeks, there was no response from the Rwanda Governance Board, which is involved in the closures. Pastor Greg Schuff is founder of Cornerstone Baptist Church. He spoke with reporter Eugene Iwimana about the situation.
I don't know what requirements that they're looking for. Now, of course, if you take a look at the Rwandan Constitution, Article 36 of the Rwandan Constitution says that we have freedom of peaceful assembly without arms is guaranteed if it is not inconsistent with the law. And the next paragraph says, prior authorization shall only be necessary if the law so requires and solely in the case of assembly in the open air, in a public place, or on a public road, and basically for public safety. So we're in a private building that I am renting for the church. And so it's very clear the Rwandan constitution says we do not need prior authorization to have church. So I don't know why they're trying to close down our assembly. That's a big problem, and that's against the constitution of Rwanda.
Do you agree that the government has the right to ask all churches to be conscious of the community needs, like paving their compounds or by making them green by planting lawns, trees and flowers that will help prevent water runoff into neighboring villages?
Yeah, within the confines of the law, of course. I'm not joking. I have no idea why our church is closed. We have a letter. All it says is that we failed to meet requirements. Now, what those requirements are, I have no idea. And for 2 weeks, I've been trying to go to RGB and local leaders and talk with them, and nobody tells me anything. So last week, I sent them a letter saying, please, number one, open our church because we have the right to meet. Or number two, if you can't do that, at least show us the rules, regulation, or the laws that we are violating and make it very clear so that we can fix whatever problem we have. So we're still waiting on an answer.
Rwandan police spokesman Thomas Badege told AFP that six Pentecostal preachers conducted illegal meetings with bad intentions aimed at calling for the directives to be defied. Is this true?
Well, let me just read what the Constitution says about it. It says in Article 48, every citizen has the right to defy orders received from his or her superior authority if the orders constitute a serious and manifest violation of human rights and public freedoms. So don't people have a right to freedom and to follow the Rwanda Constitution?
The chief executive officer of the Rwanda Governance Board, Prof. Anastase Shaka, says some churches preach misleading sermons. Do you agree that you or some other churches preach misleading sermons?
Now, which Bible school did he graduate from in order to judge? He's not a graduate of Bible college. So if he didn't graduate from Bible college, how can he judge what pastors are preaching?
This board, RGB, says there are about 700 churches that are operating without registering. Do you think it does matter if a church is registered or not?
We are not registered. I actually tried to get registered back in 2003, and for 9 years at least, they refused to register our church. And then they came out with new laws, and I just didn't get to trying to register again. But no, of course not. The Rwandan constitution is very clear. We do not need prior authorization to have meetings.
Justice Kangwaye, the head of political parties and civil organizations at the RGB, says faith-based organizations should strive for safe reliance and not be prone to external manipulation. Do you agree that your agenda is manipulated by outsiders?
Our agenda is simply to follow what is written in the Word of God. That's is all. In 14 years that I've been here, I've gotten about 3 calls from the United States. There is no way that anyone is manipulating anything that I'm doing here, I tell you that.
Do you admit to criticizing government or its policies?
You know, according to the Rwanda Constitution, that Article 33, that people have the freedom of thought, opinion, conscience, religion. You know, people have the right to their own opinion. So I don't see why or what would be wrong with churches criticizing some of the things that the governments are doing. I don't see anything wrong with it. That's a free society. I hope we're living in a free society where that's acceptable, because the only way to have change is through speaking.
That was Pastor Greg Hsu, founder of Cornerstone Baptist Church. He was speaking with reporter Eugene Uwimana from Kigali, Rwanda. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.